Hi, and welcome to North and Chick, a podcast about food, community, and well-being.
I'm Hayley North. I work as a holistic chef, food educator, yoga, and movement teacher.
And I'm Kirsten Chick, nutritional therapist, writer, and author.
Together, we're passionate about nourishing our community with food, nutrition, movement, and in many other ways.
In our work and personal lives, we meet so many inspiring people doing incredible work for their community. So we have a wonderful lineup of guests for you. We'll be sharing our conversations alongside recipes, nutrition tips, and general life tips.
We'd love your feedback, so please get in touch via our social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter as North and Chick. You can follow us there and also subscribe to our podcast to get an alert each time we release a new episode. Welcome to the North and Chick podcast series, and this month in episode 7, Kirsten, it's all about you.
Hooray!
Hooray! So yeah, as people who love shining the spotlight on others doing amazing work in their communities, it's not always the easiest to talk about ourselves, is it?
No, but I love talking, so I'm sure it'll be fine.
It's going to be great. Yeah, so where to start? Because I've known you for, gosh, 15 years approximately, maybe more.
Yeah, at least that, because when we met, you had just started teaching yoga, and yeah. I went to your classes, and then we walked home together and realised we were neighbours. And I'd not long been practising nutrition. I've been practising 18 years now. So yeah, over 15 years, I'd say.
Yeah, and to host this conversation with you today, to shine the spotlight on you today, is just really, truly an honour, because as well as being a dear friend, you are one of the most inspirational people I have met on my journey.
Thank you for that. But we have always influenced each other, haven't we? And we've worked together a long time, as well as being friends. We've run so many workshops and retreats together, and we've always met in such a special place where we really do bounce off each other and learn from each other. And
yeah, very reciprocal sharing in that respect, isn't it? And you know, like right from the beginning, finding that common ground that really resonated between what we both do in the different ways that we do it, but realizing that there's a shared language, that there's a very much a lot of common ground.
So yeah, 18 years.
18 years, and it's exciting times for you right now. You have got your book out. You took a long time researching that and putting that together. I had the great honour of reading it before it went to press. I'm looking forward to you telling us more about that as we get further into the conversation.
Yeah, it was an 18-year labour of love, really, because all of the research and all of that I've done, and everybody that has shared their story with me in consultations, in workshops, everybody who's process that I've witnessed, that's all gone into the book as alongside all of the scientific research. So it has been 18 years in the making.
And reflective of the incredible journey that you have been on personally that's led you to doing this work that you do today. So let me introduce you and then we will go from there. So Kirsten Chick is a nutritional therapist, educator, author, and speaker. Qualifying in 2003, she offers a nourishing, effective, and empowering approach to nutrition, which she shares in one-to-one consultations, in the classroom, and in her book, Nutrition Brought to Life. Kirsten has taught at several colleges over the years and currently leads modules in nutrition, holistic living, and pathophysiology to degree students at East Sussex College. She's also written and delivered modules for specialist courses in menopause, fertility and integrative oncology, and she spoke at last year's Your Life and Cancer conference. Kirsten still holds her own workshops and short courses on various health-related topics, alongside running a busy nutrition practice. Kirsten's book, Nutrition Brought to Life, was published in August 2020 and has been well received, including by Hugh Fernley Whittingstall from River Cottage, who said, I was really delighted to come across Nutrition Brought to Life by Kirsten Chick, which is clearly tuned in to the latest scientific evidence on diet and also feels inspiring, compassionate, and achievable for the reader. It's a book that I'm sure would be really helpful for a lot of people. Let's start then, Kirsten, by you telling us what you're doing at the moment.
Okay, so my work is very much focused on working one-to-one with people, which I do mostly via Zoom and over the phone. And actually, that's been the way even pre-COVID, because the vast majority of people that I work with are not local to me. So I have people all over the country, in other countries as well, that I work with on a regular basis. That's nutrition consultations, where in the first consultation I take a really detailed case history, and we work usually quite closely together to find a way of eating that really supports that person in whichever way that they need it. And also I do a lot of teaching. I teach at East Sussex College on their Complementary Therapies Foundation degree course, which is a Brighton University course. I teach pathophysiology and nutrition on that course. And I run my own workshops as well. Most of them, again, are still online, actually, but some of them are starting to be in person again. So teaching is a real love of mine. And if I haven't been in the classroom for a while and I've got some teaching coming up, sometimes it can feel a little bit stressful. It's like, where did I take this teaching work on? It's, you know, it's interrupting my client work, and it's loads of extra work on top. And the second I step into the classroom, I remember how much I love it and what it means to me to work in that way. So I guess it's mostly split between those two things, my one-to-one work and my teaching work. But then obviously alongside that, there's writing modules for various courses as well, putting recipes out there too, which I do a little bit of. So it's quite varied.
Well, in terms of the teaching, you make nutrition totally understandable to the everyday person, and you have a way of very magically kind of bringing it to life in a way that's really easy to grasp and understand, and yet you make it very real and practical. So it's great that you're in the classroom. I think you should do more of that.
I do, and I think that's one of the things that you've said to me repeatedly over years, and a number of people have. I remember on one of our retreats somebody telling me that I was queen of the analogy, and just descriptions like that have really stuck with me. I'm really glad about that, because I want to make the science accessible for people. I want people to really engage with it. There's no point just knowing this really dry, boring information and then not really being able to fully understand it in a way that's meaningful to your own health and your own life. So I really do want to bring it to life. And that's why I called the book Nutrition Brought to Life. That was very much the reason for that. But I started teaching actually when I was at university. I did a languages degree initially, and I spent a year abroad in Germany as an assistant teacher at a German school. And the teachers there kept saying to me, you're a natural, you need to become a teacher. And I was really resistant. I thought, I don't want to be a teacher. But actually, I did end up teaching English as a foreign language in Portugal for a few years, and also in the UK for a couple of years. So teaching is something that I've always done and always very much enjoyed.
Your teaching of nutrition is very physical. I seem to recall groups of people interlocking arms as in a big chain to kind of illustrate the fatty acid chains, and clay being molded to make little models of the digestive system. So it's not all just like learning formulas and chemistry and, you know, sitting there looking at textbooks or the blackboard.
Yeah, and I still do all of that, and I think it's really important. People have different learning styles. Some people are really visual, some people, they like to listen to things. But to really understand things, a lot of us are quite tactile. And when we make models, or when we actually stand up and become human models of something, it really helps us to understand what's going on. And it helps us to remember it as well. It really engages with our learning abilities in a different way. And I encourage students to do that as part of their own research, as part of their own revision practices as well.
Yeah, so you work with actual students of complementary healthcare, but I know that you also teach non-students as well, in so helping people to understand nutrition for everyday life.
Absolutely, and in a number of settings. So there's a local school just down the road from me that's a Swedish school, and I go in there and run courses to young adults who are mostly Swedish. In English, I run courses there that are really popular. I've also written and presented modules for other people's online courses that are nutrition related as well. I've recently written and presented a module for the healthcare professionals working with oncology, nurses, doctors, specialists in oncology, to bring them more awareness and knowledge and confidence in things like nutrition and exercise. So there's a lot of variety in the kinds of teaching work that I do. I remember being told when I first started practicing, it's really good to have a specialism. And I kind of do. I have a couple of specialisms. They've changed a bit over the years, but one of them that has really stuck is working with people with cancer. I spent a while working a lot with people with fertility issues. Now that's morphed into menopause. It probably is reflective of my age more than anything else. And the fact that actually menopause is suddenly less of a taboo than it was. Everyone's finally talking about it, which is just wonderful, and wanting to talk and wanting to learn more. So that's a big area that I'm involved with at the moment. But there's also a bit of me that resists becoming a specialist in a particular area, because actually I love the breadth of the work. I love that somebody could come to see me with digestive issues or skin issues, or just wanting to have a bit more energy and vitality in their life, or wanting to prevent something that seems to run in their family, or whatever it is they're coming about. I can apply the same fundamental principles, and they may take me in slightly different directions in what I'm recommending, but actually, how does this person's body work, and what would help it to move forward in a freer, more nourished way? So it's really lovely to be known to specialise in a certain area and to have that real commitment to really pursue that and really be as much of an expert in that field as you can be, but also to have the freedom to work across the board, because that makes my work a lot more interesting, but it also informs my work as well. So if I just get kind of stuck on a cancer tip, I'm in danger of just being blinkered by the research and the thought processes that everybody else is having around cancer at the moment. But if I'm also, as part of my work, doing a bit of research into MS, because I've got a few clients with MS, then I stumble across things that I think actually that's really relevant for my cancer patients as well, that I might not have connected or thought of in the same way. So I think it's really important to have a specialism within a broader practice.
Yeah, and you've mentioned there a few times the word research, and that's one of the things that I'm always astounded by your integrity in what you do, is that you are constantly, tirelessly researching, reading the medical papers, reading all the documents, keeping up with the latest science, but at the same time, you know, you have this interest in like the five element theory and the other considered more alternative aspects. You know, you're not just the straight science, you're not just over there in the alternative camp, you fuse the two together.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, because that's where I find my integrity and my authenticity as a practitioner, for a start. There's a lot of controversy around scientific research and how much is it skewed by various factors. But at the end of the day, statistics are always going to be blinkered. So, for example, if you wanted to find out how many apples a person should eat a day in order to keep the doctor away, actually, you'd have to do quite a lot of research for that, or quite a massive trial for that. You'd have to take lots of different people having one apple, lots of people a day having no apples, lots of people a day having two, a lot having three, a lot having four, a lot having five, and so on. and compare them to each other. And you could just do that and come up with some statistics that you could interpret in a number of different ways. But then really, to be fully scientific about it, you would then have to repeat that experiment in spring, summer, autumn and winter, because our bodies will respond to that apple in different ways according to the time of year. And then you'd have to repeat that in the southern hemisphere, in the northern hemisphere, near the equator. There's just so much involved. You'd have to look at the individuals eating the apples and see what kind of events they'd been through that year or those months where they were eating those apples. So quite quickly, we can see that any piece of scientific research is going to have been narrowed in some way for practical reasons alone, if for nothing else. We have to look at everything. We have to look at the science, and we have to look at the bigger picture and the smaller picture of the individual that you're working with. Otherwise, you're just trying to fit a round peg into a square hole. So I'm really passionate about seeing what's out there in terms of research. What have people looked at? And there is a lot. This whole thing around, is it the science, is it evidence-based, what's your approach, or is your approach human-centered? I don't think there's an either or. I think we have to do both, and we have to do it to the best of our ability and our authenticity. So I look at the science base, I look at the evidence base, I incorporate that as much as I possibly can, but I look at that in the context of everything else that I know influences the individual human being. We live in this universe that is always changing, and we live in societies that are always changing, and we live day-to-day lives that have greater and lesser amounts of stress day-to-day, moment-to-moment. And we know how that influences the human body at cellular level, in terms of how your heart beats, in terms of what moves in and out of your cells, in terms of how well your immune system's functioning, in terms of how your brain is functioning, in terms of how you're processing emotions. We know all of that. That isn't kind of Wookiee alternative health. That's embedded in science as well. So I think we have to reassess this. Is it evidence-based or is it woo-wah? Yeah, so that's a little rant about that.
Okay, so give us a bit of background. You know, we've all got a personal story, what drives us to come to what we do when we're so passionate about it in this way. So how did you get into this?
Well, like many people, I got ill. That's often a routine. I got ill. I got cancer. This was over 20 years ago. I'm completely fine now. But it really was a wake-up call. It took a couple of years for it to be a wake-up call. It wasn't an easy process. I spent a good couple of years recovering emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, mentally, as well as physically, from the whole process and from what it really meant to me and my life. It really shook things up for me. And I did what many people do in that situation. I started to blame myself and got really quite depressed about the fact that I had brought this upon myself. You hear that a lot in the kind of the wellness industry now. There's this whole message of, if you get ill, then it's because you haven't looked after yourself properly. If you do what we do, if you do this every day, and if you do that, and if you eat like this, and if you do these kind of things, then you won't get ill. So if you get ill, you haven't been doing it properly. I have huge amounts of problems with that message that I'm sure we'll come to. But that's not why I blamed myself. I instinctively did that already. I had no access to any complementary healthcare at the time. And I had to come through the other side of that and realize that blaming myself was just another stress that I was adding into my body. It was just another thing that was preventing me from living a full and vibrant life. I probably got ill for so many different reasons, and my lifestyle may have contributed, possibly did contribute in some ways, but it wasn't the only reason I got ill. And I had to really come to terms with that, and in some ways let go of why did I get ill, and instead think, okay, well, I am ill. Human beings get ill. how do I move forward from this? What do I do now? What do I want the rest of my life to look like and feel like? And I found myself stepping into a really amazing and joyful place where I could explore that in a way that I never had before. I mean, life had been really fun and exciting, and I'd been involved in some amazing projects that I'm really proud of. But this was the first time that I stepped into what I wanted to do and what felt right for my life and who I was and who I wanted to be. And part of that was studying nutrition. I didn't really study it with any view to necessarily working a lot with people with cancer. That just happened naturally right from the very start, but also as a lot of other people as well. So a great breadth to the kind of people that I worked with. But it was a really important driver, actually, in my early research as well, in how can we keep cells behaving in a really healthy way. You know, we all create cancer cells every day anyway, but we have these amazing systems in our bodies that deal with that. So how can we support those amazing systems? So on that kind of scientific cellular level, I wanted to find that out. But working with nutrition also for me was really just a way of just stepping into an area that felt right to be in, that felt like the next stage of my life. So everything came naturally from there. I didn't seek to necessarily become a full-time nutritional therapist. That just happened. I didn't seek to teach in nutrition. I got invited to teach and then remembered how much I loved teaching. I never actively looked those jobs out. I got invited to them. So it really all unfolded in a really natural and wonderful way. And even meeting you, Hayley, and the work that we did together, it was something that unfolded really beautifully rather than being something that we had to kind of really push.
Absolutely. I think that's something very similar in our lives, and what's led us to do what we do is that it's come from a personal journey first. And it was never our intention to have a career doing the work that we've actually ended up doing and sharing with people. It's come from this kind of personal project.
Yeah, exactly. And the more I discovered how wonderful and dynamic the human body is, the more I wanted to share that with people and just say, you know, hey, don't take it for granted. You know, you're not just walking along because that's what you do, or breathing or lifting your hand or whatever you're doing in this moment involves countless number of moment to moment, miraculous, amazing processes that are all interconnected and beautiful. And I just got excited about that and wanted to share that. And also with the interaction that food has with that, we take our food for granted. We think, okay, we need to have a bit of food for fuel to keep us going through the day. Or we need to get our protein for our building blocks. That's kind of as far as we generally get with food and how we think about it. Or maybe how tasty it is, which is a wonderful thing. But what I really got excited about is that how the second you put food into your mouth, it becomes an interactive and crucial part of those myriad processes that are happening from moment to moment in your body to help you think and breathe, to enable you to scratch an ear or whatever it is that you're doing that just seems so simple, that kind of regulate your reproductive cycles, that carry nerve signals through the body. Just how special that all is, and how food is a part of each of those tiny processes and that complex dynamic relationship that people have with their food. I just got so excited with that, and I just wanted to share that just to help people appreciate what amazing, wonderful things are going on with their bodies all of the time.
Yeah, which is why your approach to nutrition is so exciting, because it's not anything to do with eat this many calories and make sure you get this much fat or this much protein, or, you know, just focused around those kind of basic building blocks of what nutrition is often thought to be about. It's much more dynamic and interactive, as you say. And that's what you really bring to the table, which is, pardon the pun, in how you address food within your nutrition practice.
Yeah, and we can talk about all of that stuff, but we can talk about it in a way that makes it meaningful to what it does for us and why we're doing it. So I do talk about proteins and amino acids and things like that, but I also get people thinking about how they feel when they eat different kinds of proteins, the energetics of food as well, and how that can really vary from one person to another. So one person might feel that when they eat too much meat, they feel really heavy and dense. And if they eat something lighter, like some vegetable proteins, maybe some hummus instead, they feel much more lighter and full of energy. Whereas the next person might feel the complete opposite and feel much more vitality when they just eat animal protein, but when they start eating pulses, it really makes them feel dense and lethargic and bloated and not great. So really exploring people's personal relationships with food, I think that has to be the starting point and the goal as well. So when people work with me one-to-one, I will give them guidelines. I will recommend guidelines that they can explore. But the ultimate goal is to get them feeling their own way through food. So becoming more aware of how different ways of eating and different foods make them feel as an individual at that particular moment in time. Because of course, that's going to change as well through the seasons, from day to day sometimes, and certainly through our lives.
Why do you think we've become so disconnected from this? Why are we not taught about food in this way from a young age? Do you have any perspective on that?
Oh, I think there are probably so many reasons. And I think one reason is that for a long time, we just wanted to get really scientific about everything. And we thought that if we could understand everything intellectually and create rules for things, then everything would be so much better, because we would have these rules to live by. And that's a really wonderful and noble aim, and I really applaud it. But actually, it doesn't take into account individual differences and the different influences of it being a sunny, warm day one day and a cold, wet day the next day, for example. You'd think we'd be more aware of that in the UK, but you know, we like to put things in boxes. We like to create rules about things. It makes life seem easier. And I think that's at the heart of it. I think anything that makes life a little bit easier, because there's so much that we need to worry about. There's so many stresses and responsibilities that we have. If we can just have one less thing to focus on, because it's all sorted for us, we can just go to the shop and buy that thing and know that it takes care of all of our needs. It just makes life quicker, easier. And if that worked, that would be amazing. You know, I totally get that and why we have the need for that. And we like to simplify things generally anyway, especially when we're in a stressed state or a fearful state or a traumatized state. The part of the brain that really rationalizes things and thinks about the gray areas and those bits in between that I'm so fond of, but that part of the brain just kind of shuts down a bit. Our brain needs things to be black or white, one extreme or another. And I think we're seeing that in all walks of life at the moment. Either you are completely scientific or you are completely wacky and out there. Either you are right wing or you are left wing. Either you are this or you are that. It's the only thing a brain that's in that level of stress and trauma and fear can deal with and process. I think the real way forward is actually to address all of the stress, the fear, the trauma. And we've talked to some really interesting people in these podcasts and how they're working with that. And I guess my way of working with that is one-to-one individually with people.
Yeah, and you've put together this incredible book to help your clients and to help those, of course, to have access to that can't get to see you for one reason or another, can't get to work with you personally, to get this out to the wider world. So tell us a bit more about your book.
Well, it's called nutrition brought to life. I'm so proud of it. I really wasn't expecting to be this proud of it, but it's come together so beautifully, and it's such a good time for me in terms of where I've got to with my understanding of nutrition. So all of the research I've done and all of the work that I've done one-to-one with people, everything that I've witnessed, everything that they've shared with me, and all of my teaching work, the book came out a year ago, so just under 17 years of that, brought me to a place where I could actually formulate what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it. And not only that, it was actually 5 years in the writing, because a lot of extra research went into the book just to make sure that what I was saying really was as accurate as could be. And also, it's quite tough writing a book whilst running a business that's quite a busy business and everything else that I do on top. But it came together at the right time. And it came together because the publishers, Alchemia Publishing, Harvey and Debs, came to me one day and said, would you like to write a book? I, of course, said, I'd love to write a book. It felt like the right time to do that. And what they brought to the table was an ability and a desire to produce something that is beautiful. I mean, it really is beautiful to look at, to feel, to read. It's on slightly coloured paper, so it's softer on the eye. We found some really gorgeous images. It's hardback, it's got a ribbon, it's got a beautiful cover that's actually a photograph of chopped up vegetables made to look like flowers growing. Kristen Mayer designed that. She's amazing. So yeah, it's this beautiful book that says everything that I want to say right now. And every time I look at it, I think, yeah, it's been over a year now since it came out, and it still says everything I want to say right now. So I'm really proud of it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to find its way into many people's lives and be incredible, useful resource. Nutrition books are not often easy to read, but this is really easy to read.
Brilliant. That's what I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be really accessible and engaging, easy to read. And I wanted it to be practical as well. It's a practical guide to nutrition. So at the end of every chapter, there's an opportunity to reflect on some of the points that have come up. There are some suggestions about things that people might want to try to play with. There are also 50 recipes in the back of the book. So at the end of each chapter, it says, check out these recipes on these pages that are particularly relevant to what we've been talking about in this chapter. And the final chapter is a blueprint for how you can put the information together in a way that's workable with, because there's a lot of information in the book and it can be a little bit overwhelming to work with that much information. So really encouraging people to put it together in a way that they can just proceed gently, gradually, step by step, which is how I kind of like to work generally anyway.
Going back to cancer for a moment, because I know that's a huge part of what you do. So cancer is one in two now, and most oncologists know nothing or very little about nutrition. And some of the dietary advice given, I know I've been through personal experience in some of those meetings where dietary advice is given that just seems way off the mark and not appropriate for people going through cancer. What do you think we can do about this? How can we make food and nutrition a bigger part, a more essential part of a cancer patient's recovery and their journey?
Oh, that's a really good question. There's so much that we can do nutritionally, and there are lots of mixed messages about what we can do. I guess that's a conversation for another time. There is a lot that we can do to support our bodies. Our bodies are really quite amazing. So I mentioned earlier, we continually make cancer cells all of the time. Every day, we're all making cancer cells, but our bodies have incredible ways of dealing with that. And not just, you know, one or two incredible ways, but a number of methods that it has for keeping that in check. Really, we're very self-regulating and self-correcting in our bodies. It's really quite incredible. There's something I read in the New Scientist the other day that just made me go, wow. I often compare the human body to the planet, and this kind of explains why. So apparently in the 2019-2020 wildfires in Australia. So there was a season of wildfires. 715 million tonnes of carbon dioxide were released into the atmosphere as a result of that season. So that's equivalent of the entire annual emissions of Germany, 715 million tonnes. About 80% of that was absorbed by algal blooms that began growing when the iron-rich ash from the fires rained down into the water. So those fires produced the pollution. They also produced the means for mopping up 80% of that pollution. We're part of this planet. Internally, we do the same thing. Actually, in every moment, your cells are creating toxins, as well as the fact that we're breathing in toxins and absorbing toxins in other ways. We're creating them too. And we have ways of dealing with that, of mopping that up. So we're very self-regulating and very self-correcting. And just like the planet as well, we're very finely attuned to seasons, to various cycles. So we have this cyclical relationship, but that can be affected. So if the seasons are disrupted, or if we get out of kilter with those seasons and cycles, we can be affected by that disruption. And in the same way, just as the planet is really choking in pollution at the moment, so are we. We're just surrounded by so much pollution that we've generated ourselves, actually, but it's in the air, it's in the water, it's in our food. We're choking because a lot of that, it's overwhelming our self-regulating mechanisms, things like the liver, the kidneys, the immune system. Stress adds to all of this. That's something that's been studied in great depth now, how stress can add to that overwhelm in very physical biochemical ways. And poor diet obviously will add to this as well, but not just add to this. So yes, it's a contributing factor, but often it's a result as well, because when we're choking in pollution and stress, we naturally reach for what we've taught our bodies is the simplest, easiest thing to digest and get energy out of, which might be fast food or something heavily laden with sugar, for example, which from time to time may be okay, but when we're relying on that all of the time, it's going to contribute to illness and disease in the bodies. Can't really blame ourselves for that. It's a symptom of where we're at right now. So to really counteract this, rather than just give ourselves a really hard time about what we're eating and how we're eating, we need to settle everything down so it can self-regulate again. And one part is giving as much support as possible to the liver, the kidneys, the immune system, and so on. But we also need to calm down the nervous system, calm down the adrenals, take our bodies out of that stress response, because our stress response, in the simplest way we can describe it, is that we tense, everything tenses. So things don't flow around the body so easily. And various mechanisms really change. Our brain works differently. Our digestive system gets downregulated. Our reproductive system gets downregulated. Really basic functions in our body change. So we need to change them back again by calming down the nervous system, calming down the adrenals. And there are ways that we can do that, to making sure that we've got certain nutrients, like, for example, vitamin B5, like zinc, like magnesium. They can all really help. But fundamentally, we need to change the way that we eat and the relationship that we have to food. I've had so many people come to see me, especially people with cancer, who are terrified that they might be eating the wrong thing. So they end up eating barely anything. So my primary goal with not just people with cancer, but with everybody really, is to improve our relationship. And I say our because it's a work in progress for me too. We all need to improve our relationship with food and with our bodies and have it coming from a place of self-nourishment, self-love, self-commitment, rather from a place of prescription and fear and stress and worry or anger. You know, there's so many emotions connected to food. And that's how it is. We can't change that. We can't separate emotions from food. But how can we find acceptance with that and move forward?
Yeah, I find this fascinating, the external, the planetary climate change issues. But there is an internal climate change happening for each of us as well. I really feel that also is not being addressed in the same way. As you said, we're part of this planet. We're not separate from the natural world around us. The climate change is happening inside also.
Absolutely. And so we need to address all of it to really become amazingly healthy, vital human beings. We need to be addressing the planet. We need to be addressing society and how we look after each other, how we live together. We need to be addressing all of those things. We need to be nourishing ourselves and the people around us, whether that's with food, whether that's with laughter, whether that's with other ways that we support each other, with love. We need to be showing love and kindness to each other, to the planet, to ourselves. One of my favorite definitions of nutrition is concerned with anything that nourishes you. It's not just food.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about really being well as an individual, we're talking about actually the wellness of the planet, the wellness of everybody around us. You can't separate any of that out. And coming back to the science of that, surely this is what science is all about. Every time scientists do some research, they're looking through a microscope at an aspect of that. You could imagine thousands, millions of scientists out to space, each with a telescope and a pair of binoculars, and they're each looking in massive detail at a different part of the planet. And eventually you'll be able to put that all together and see the whole planet and see everything that's going on, all of the different perspectives, all together. And we'll be able to use that to nourish the whole planet, which includes us. But not just looking at one perspective and saying that that perspective is different from, you know, the guy that's looking at a little village in Japan is seeing something very different from the person that's looking at a city in Australia. So rather than them arguing about what they're looking at and what they're seeing, can we put this all together and have this as a moving picture where we can actually work together? And that's another picture of everybody in society working together and sharing information and sharing experience so that we can step back and see the bigger picture and then step closer and put in the work to support it and nourish it. Yeah, we need to think globally. We need to broaden our minds. We need to open our minds and we need to work together.
What does a healthy person, a healthy planet, a healthy being, what does that look like to you?
Well, I guess there's two versions of that. There's the ideal one of the person that lives in that incredible place that we're far from, where there isn't any pollution, where we do all work together and live together as one. I suppose evolved socialism, where human beings are fully evolved enough to be able to create a truly socialist environment. I guess that would be the backdrop, and we don't have that. So currently, in what we do have, in the planet that we are living on right now, then actually health looks like it includes being ill. It includes having times when we are ill. It includes having times when we're not firing on all cylinders, when we feel tired, exhausted, when we feel out of kilter, times when we feel mentally, emotionally jagged, disrupted, on the floor. It includes all of those things. It includes death. But we're able to, well, move through all of those things. We're able to keep moving and not get stuck in any one of those places. We're able to learn from situations that we're in. When I first started practicing, I was like, yeah, this is great. We can do everything with food. You know, food is the answer. But of course it isn't. And it's really kind of arrogant of me to believe that I can just go and fix people with food. That's not what I'm about. lots of different things are the answer. And some things that I might not even agree with might be somebody's answer, and it might be the things that take them forward. And again, coming back to working with people with cancer, this is a really good example of this. So when I first started, I was very much of the mindset that I really didn't agree with chemotherapy. I really didn't agree with radiotherapy. There has to be a better way. There's still a massive part of me that thinks, yes, there definitely has to be a better way. But in the 15 years plus I've been working with people, I've witnessed so many people going through radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And you know what? It's most of the time, it's really not pretty. But actually, a lot of the time, it's worked for people. It's been what they needed at that time. And they've had the fallout from it, but they may well have had fallout from another approach that they've taken. And it's humbled me. It's made me have to step back and think, you know what? I don't know it all. I don't understand it all. But I cannot be arrogant enough to think that if I think something is wrong, then it's going to be wrong. That was a real kind of wake-up call for me to see some people thriving on chemotherapy and being in touch with them years later as well, and for it to have been a really positive thing in their lives. So that's been really humbling, and that's been a real lesson that actually we judge each other too much and we judge each other's choices too much. That's happening a lot at the moment, especially with COVID and vaccinations and mask wearing and things like that. What saddens me most about it all is the judgment that people have for each other because of the choices that they're making. So what I consider to be a healthy person is somebody who can make authentic choices in the moment about how to deal with their current situation and not be judged for those choices and not judge other people for the choices that they make that might be different.
Hear, hear. We've definitely got to start there before we can start moving forward, that's for sure.
Yeah, and hopefully there will be a day where actually treatment for cancer and other illnesses has moved forwards, but what currently we are where we're at, and we work where we're at and honour people's choices and honour the process of what's going on there as well for people, and honour that there can be something really beautiful in everything.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today, Kirstin, on the lovely podcast series.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I love our conversations, Hayley. We've had so many conversations over the years like this without recording them. And you direct them in a way that just really makes me think deeply about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And that really brings interesting angles into conversations. You've got a real gift for that. So thank you.
You are very welcome. But one thing we ask all of our guests on the North in Chick podcast series, and it's your turn now, Kirstin, is to share your food memory with us, please.
Do you know what? I didn't have to think very long about this, but it was a surprise. It was a food memory I'd forgotten about, but it came to me as soon as I thought about the question. So maybe 6, 7. And it's a very simple memory of eating cucumber. So my father was an accountant and he had lots of different clients. Most of them were either in the food or pub business or secondhand car dealers in the East End of London. And he was very much into going around and visiting, and many of his clients became good friends of his. So there was this Greek family that ran a Greek restaurant, and my mum tells me we would often go to celebrations there. There were like massive gatherings. I was too young to really remember them. I do remember one that was a barbecue on the beach, which was amazing, with just loads of people running around eating, sharing, laughing. I don't know if everybody there was family. It always felt like everybody was. I mean, we weren't family, but we felt like we were part of it. But my dad would go around to visit his clients to do their accounts or have meetings with them. He would just travel in his car and go and see them. And in school holidays, I would be with him in the back of the car. And when we went to this Greek restaurant, I would be shoved in the kitchen and given a cucumber and I would just sit there and munch. It would be like a whole cucumber. And for me, this was the most amazing treasure of a thing. I was never allowed to do this at home. And I was like a real chocolate fiend when I was a kid. If it wasn't chocolate, what was the point? Or or scampi and chips. That's all I ate, chocolate or scampi and chips. And I covered everything in ketchup. It wasn't like I really loved my fruit and vegetables. I wasn't that kind of child. But this was the biggest treat ever, to be allowed to just sit and eat a cucumber. So that's my food memory. It's simple. It's tied in with memories of family and situations that felt really safe and comfortable and joyful. And just that simple, refreshing treat of cucumber.
Oh, isn't that why we just love this part of the podcast? Because the food memory is always so rich. And like you said, it taps into these stories, these emotional moments that we will just never forget.
Yeah, I had another one actually that was around a goat curry.
Oh, yum.
But it was another friend of my dad's, and I think they probably started out as clients and quickly became friends. It was a family that had not long moved from the mountains in the north of India to Chelmsford. It's too long a story, but my dad helped them procure this goat. They made a goat curry. They invited us round. I just remember there being people everywhere in this house. And again, we were made to feel like family. It was the most delicious thing I'd ever tasted in my life. Maybe this was the start of my foodie journey. But it was just so incredible, the flavours and the love that went into that meal. So it's something that I've really learned from my dad as well. And I had a really complex relationship with him. But this, just going out and talking to people and becoming part of their life, and having these rich experiences with other families from lots of different backgrounds, that's something that I've learned to value from him.
Thank you, Kirsten. Well, I adore cucumbers and I adore goat curry. Now I'm really hungry and want both of those things. Thanks, Kirsten.
Thank you, Hayley.
So it's time for our recipe of the month. And when it comes to single ingredients, I think cucumber has to be one of my absolute favourites. So it's such a joy that Kirsten brought that up as her food memory. Apart from enjoying cucumbers simply as they are, eating them whole, or chopping them up to put them on a salad, what else can you do with them? I often make a quick pickled salad with cucumbers in the summer when they're in abundance in season, and they are just perfect to accompany something like a quiche or a tart, a frittata, a stir fry, or with grilled fish. So many ways that you can enjoy them, even as a little salad by themselves. So you start by preparing your cucumber. My preferred way to do this is to use a potato peeler and just shave off thin ribbons of the cucumber. You could also use a spiralizer if you've got one of those gadgets. Alternatively, just chop them up however you wish. To make your quick pickle liquid, add the following to a bowl. So you need vinegar. I like to use apple cider vinegar, salt, a little bit of sea salt, and soy sauce or tamari or namu shoyu. Something sweet, you can use raw honey, brown rice syrup, some coconut sugar or raw brown sugar, for instance. So in terms of quantities, for one large cucumber, I'd probably put about half a cup of vinegar to 2 tablespoons of tamari or soy sauce, a pinch of salt, like half a teaspoon, about the same, about 1 to 2 tablespoons of honey or liquid sweetener, or 1 tablespoon or so of dry sugar. So this is all about the taste. You want to get that lovely sourness from the vinegar with a lovely balance of sweet and salt there in the background. So have a taste and adjust as you need to. Then add your cucumber ribbons to the bowl with the pickling liquid. Make sure the cucumbers are totally submerged. Stir them around a little bit so they can get completely coated and they're sitting in the liquid. And just cover your bowl and leave at room temperature for about an hour. And when you're ready to serve, give a final toss of the cucumbers in their liquid and add some black sesame seeds. I also like to have a little pinch of chili flakes. So remember that this is a really quick, fresh, tangy cucumber salad. If you're going to pickle cucumbers for a longer period of time, then I would not recommend chopping them in the ribbons because they're really delicate. So chop them a little bit more robustly, a little bit chunkier. And let's add in another little quick recipe while we're here. How about a tzatziki? So really grating cucumber finely, squeezing out in your hands to just remove the excess liquid. Put that to one side and drink that later. It's absolutely delicious. And then adding your squeezed grated cucumber into a bowl with some yogurt. I like to put in there a little bit of lemon juice, plenty of freshly chopped mint, a little bit of grated garlic and some salt and pepper to finish. Stir that all together. Absolutely delicious. We hope you've enjoyed episode 7 of the North and Chick podcast series and look forward to seeing you next month. So if you enjoyed that, please subscribe to our North and Chick podcast and also follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter as North and Chick, all lowercase, no spaces.